There have been many important players in the fight for social justice and racial equality since the 1960s. One of the most important and perhaps least known is Morris Deese. He's an attorney and co-founder of the Southern Poverty Law Center. He has waged successful legal campaigns against hate crimes in general and the Ku Klux Klan in particular. He continues in spite of a spate of death threats against him. He'll be in St. Louis to take part in a St. Louis Speaker Series panel discussion on racism. I spoke with him last week and asked for his take on today's racial climate.
Well, I think this has been one of the worst political careers for racial issues, not just African Americans, but Latinos, Muslims, so many other different groups. You can have a program on this that would last several days, and you couldn't say it all. I think that one of the things that I was told by the group, that leaders of the group, in terms of the audience questioning, is they wanted to stay away from politics and just talk about stuff in general. And that may well be what they would like to do, and that's what we will do, I guess, as an audience. I mean, as speakers, attempt to do among ourselves and the way they got it divided up. But getting back to your question, I think that it's a critical issue, and I don't really see it being avoided in the campaign. Donald Trump has made race a serious issue. The Southern Poverty Law Center doesn't endorse candidates, but we also bring out things that we deal with, like hate. And never has hate been such a focus in a political campaign, whether it's blacks or Latinos or people who are coming from different Arab countries, by a man who essentially is appealing to middle-class whites, most of them not educated.
Doesn't seem to be very far below the surface, as you indicate, with the...
Right.
You know, I can't imagine that people would say you're going to have the kind of discussion you're having here, and you can't talk politics, because it really has set the tone of the day.
It really has, and probably most of the panels they have are current in some respects. Some of them are more intellectual. But I think this is one where it's going to come up. The various speakers have a background in this area. You know, I personally grew up on a small cotton farm in Alabama, born in 1936, and, you know, we didn't own any land. We just farm rented land around the community. And so I had an opportunity to work in the cotton fields alongside black people and my parents. And so I had a different viewpoint. My daddy was a progressive-minded person, not a racist like his brothers, who were members of the Klan, and, you know, starting in 1954 with Brown versus Board. And Dad ran a small cotton gin, and the black people liked us in the community. And we weren't obviously card-carrying liberals or anything like that. We were just fair-minded people. He was killed in a car wreck in 1960. He was kind of young. And when that happened, as many blacks came to the funeral as white people did, which is quite unusual. And this, working with my mother, who became a justice of the peace, and my dad in the community, I didn't take on any liberal airs immediately, but when I got to law school in University of Alabama, I had an opportunity to participate in the first integration activity that I'd ever even seen. Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on the bus. I was in high school, headed off to college, paid little or no attention to it all because I left home in 55. But when I got to Alabama, they attempted to integrate it in 1955 or 56, and I had an opportunity to, you know, kind of take a stand.
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought this part of your history up, because I wanted to talk about your transition from someone who had worked for George Wallace at one point, then moving on to work for people like George McGovern and Ted Kennedy. Talk about a transition.
Well, it's not that big a transition, though, because George Wallace, when he ran the first time, I kept from going to law school one semester in order to work in his campaign to get young people to vote. Well, at the time, his opponent was John Patterson, who had the backing of the Klan. I mean, they got out and testified and spoke for him and produced things for him all over the state. George Wallace would end one of his speeches in from a back of a pickup truck or whatever you talked about in small towns back then, and he always said, "Well, I got this sheet right here. Let's see if George Wallace, let's see if John Patterson under this sheet with the Klan. Nobody wants the Klan to run in the state of Alabama." And so he took a progressive stand, and it was beat. it was an unfortunate thing he did. And after that, he ran the second time. He said he wasn't going to be out-segged again. Naturally, I didn't help him at that point. I wasn't an enemy of his, but I just wasn't. That wasn't my viewpoint. And that was 1964 when he ran. I forgot. I'm trying to think of times now. That's right. He ran in 64 when he ran the second time. Or 62. I was out of law school and working, and I just ignored him.
And then the move to McGovern and Kennedy, easy enough.
Right. Yeah, it was. And I had a company that started in college with Millard Fuller, who founded Habitat, and we published books and sold them all over the country. Actually, I bought him out in 65, and I sold it to the Los Angeles Times in 1970. But our company was the largest publishers of cookbooks in the United States. Yeah. We've published millions of cookbooks, sold them for fundraising through clubs and organizations, and numerous other things. And so it was a great opportunity to have some income coming in from 1960 when I got out of college until 1970 when I sold out. And it gave me an opportunity to represent people. You know, I wasn't practicing law. I didn't have a law office in 63 to 60 to 70 when I only ran a law office for a short time. But I kept my, you know, my law books around, and I was always doing cases in the mid-60s right on up. And there were one single-shot case here, there, and yonder, and got involved in a Selma march by really hauling people over to Selma to march the second time. So I began to get my feet wet a little bit, but the Southern Poverty Law Center didn't come about until actually 1971, when I took the work that I'd been doing in my law office and just simply incorporated it to raise money.
What kind of work is the Law Center doing today?
Well, the Law Center today is continuing the work it started in late 60s, and that is just to level the playing field on all the civil rights laws that are on the books that were caused by the civil rights movement. And then in 1980, we set up a project called Klan Watch, and then we changed it to the Intelligence Project because we started going after Klan groups and realized that a lot of the young people who were committing these crimes with the encouragement of Klan leaders were really all young, under 25. So we set up this Teaching Tolerance program to educate young people about tolerance, and today it's used in over 100,000 schools in America. We give away about $8 to $10 million a year worth of material, videos, texts, teachers' guides. It's a nationwide project with the idea that if you can get to some of these young people that nobody got to them before, they decided to join the Klan and find a family. And then in 1990, we started a project called Teaching Tolerance, and it goes to, I made a mistake earlier, we have 100,000 schools that we use. The Intelligence Project goes to all the law enforcement in the country, which is about 70,000 different agencies and people. But the project that we have trying to educate young people goes to over 100,000 schools. Of a magazine, it goes to 500,000 teachers. And we've published texts and teachers' guides, and two of our texts have won Oscars, and two more have got Oscar nominations. Mm-hmm. They're quite good productions, and they're all distributed free. So if we'll do a documentary about Cesar Chavez and the work of the Latinos, it's going to get picked up by 70,000 to 90,000 schools. And they're nice little short 30-minute documentaries that can be used as part of an education device.
What are you teaching young people or telling young people today about the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court's activities in the area of civil rights these days?
Well, we don't really teach, you know, a subject like what does the Supreme Court do. We might talk about a case they took on, like the same-sex marriage of gay people. And clearly we won the case by one of the more progressive liberal judges voting with more progressive judges taking over by getting one of the conservative judges to go along with them. And so we might discuss it that way. But in our Teaching Tolerance lessons, there's a lot of history about democracy and fair play, and that becomes part of one article or another article. Our material is done for K through 12. So you've got all kinds of material that's put out. And then in addition, you know, we may have a case in court. We have 45 lawyers working around the Southeast for our work. And all these cases are trying to either change the law or make a new law, or some change something that where we feel like it violates the statutes or constitution of the United States. So that comes up every day.
Yeah, well, I was thinking of some tinkering that's been going on recently with the Voting Rights Act, with the Supreme Court. And then, of course, states all over the country, almost half of them, I think, are now actively trying to promote legislation for photo voter IDs, Missouri certainly being one of them. I mean, these are areas that could certainly have an impact on...
Well, we definitely deal with this within Teaching Tongues. We may have an article for senior high school students about voting laws. When the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a key section of the Civil Rights Voting Act, Congress, state legislatures, I should say, in numerous states, 7-8 states, immediately passed up within weeks, and most of those laws have been struck down. Pennsylvania was struck down, and so many of the others. Alabama has not been struck down, but it's been wavered by the court in certain aspects. So, you know, I don't think there's any doubt that the political right in the country wants to make it more difficult for people of color, minorities, and liberals and others to vote. And in addition, all across the Southeast especially, you know, just a small criminal record keeps you from voting unless you go down and make a presentation to get your rights back, which I think once you've been served your sentence for whatever you did, you certainly have the right to vote. And a person who writes a bad check, once they've gone to jail, paid the fine, can go in and buy whiskey or beer or license for a car or get a gun. You can do a whole lot of things. You know, once things are cleared up, but to vote, that's different.
Yeah, a lot of people think there's a national strategy out there to suppress vote through the various means that you indicated.
I don't think it's any question that the political right, and that doesn't mean all Republicans, but it does mean quite a few, are doing their best to cut down on the number of people of color voting. When I was on that farm in the 30s and 40s. Growing up, 15% of the people of America were people of color. Today, the number is like 37% people of color, and by the year 2041, it's going to be over 50%. So America's suffering from a change in the activities of our population, economic environment, and the people that are supporting Donald Trump this time represent, you know, a bit of a holdover to those individuals who just can't call up down at the shop and get a job for Junior because Daddy worked there. You got some fair hiring practices going on.
Are you at all dismayed by the fact that issues of social justice and race relations have barely been spoken about during this political campaign? Social justice issues and race relations issues in terms of, you know, proposals to make our situation better in these areas.
Yeah, well, I think the Democrats who are running to take back seats and to gain seats have certainly raised those issues because those people are going to elect them to office. I think on the Republican side, it's just the opposite. You know, these people want to take over America, and they do it with the voting rights. And we wasn't for the voting law to be passed in the first place, and we don't think the states ought to be punished because of their past history. And it's pretty clear. I don't know that it's, you say it and talk about it in every campaign, but when you get a person shot on the street by a police officer, you got two sides of it, the cop side and the policeman and the person shot side. Most of the time, the person shot probably deserved to be shot. They were doing something to produce a security problem for the community, for their neighbors, their friends, their spouses, whatever, but quite a few of them don't. And in some countries in the world, when you have a person out with a gun or a knife or just appearing to be a problem, they call in backup and surround the area. It may take more money and more time, but that individual gets to live. And that's what America's got to come to.
Yeah, we seem a long way from that at the present time.
That's true.
Time is getting away, and I know you have to go, but I'm just curious as to your evaluation of where we are today vis-a-vis where we were in the 60s, 50 years ago. I would imagine that someone with your experience would be somewhat dismayed at the lack of progress.
I am, you know, in comparing the America in the 50s and 60s and today, I'm happy and dismayed. I'm happy that we've had these such changes that young people, particularly minorities, sometimes don't even think about where they came from, and that's one of the issues. On the other hand, the issues have changed. Young people just take for granted that they got these rights, and that all they got to do is just go out there and they'll be, you know, honored. Well, that's not necessarily true. And we see in the cases we file discrimination, especially against poor people, dealing with loans they make and interest they're charged, buying cars, houses, health care, prisons, all these things pick on the lowest economic levels. And those are the ones who, you know, I think the Republicans see is taking over the country. So let's just keep them locked up.
A lot of work yet to be done.
Yes, sir.
Morris Deese, thank you so much for spending some time with us. I know St. Louis is looking forward to seeing you here this week, and we are too.
Well, Don, thank you for setting this interview up, and look forward to listening to it.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
Morris Deese will be joined by Goldie Taylor and Jason Riley for a panel discussion on racism in America to open the new season of the St. Louis Speaker Series tomorrow night, 8, at Powell Hall. You can find more details at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.